It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Moose are part of Alaska life in so many ways. As dinner, as a road hazard, and as an exciting visitor in your backyard. And as a really amazing animal that deserves our respect for living in some of the harshest conditions on the planet, from coastal Alaska to the Arctic. You might think you already know all about them, but I'm betting almost everyone will learn more on today's show. I know I certainly did when I put it together. On the first half, we'll hear from a moose biologist who has followed these animals in a single area for more than 35 years, learning the differences between individuals and new ideas about how to manage moose and predators. On the second half, we'll talk about our urban moose. They're the source of funny and tragic stories and a part of what makes city life in Alaska interesting. As part of that, everyone will get some information you can use. My first guest is Vic Van Ballenberg, who is a moose biologist. Studied moose at Denali National Park for 37 years, knows a lot of moose, and is the author of a spectacular book called In the Company of Moose, which is published by Stackpole Books, which includes his gorgeous photography and some of his findings and thoughts from his research. Thanks for being with us, Vic.
Well, thank you.
So, tell me about this study that you've done for so many decades in Denali. And I know that for biologists, studying something over one area and one animal over a long time period can give you some special insights.
Yeah, the value of long-term research is very important. And when I first started the study there in 1980, that was my goal, to be able to follow a moose population over a long term and to try to document the changes that occurred and try to understand some of the reasons for the changes.
Yeah, and I want to learn a lot about that area and about those moose and some of the controversial issues that surround that. And also, listeners, I hope, are going to learn a lot about the animal today, its biology, and it's such an important animal in Alaska. What are some of the more surprising things that you have found in your research up at Denali?
Well, one thing that really has stood out to me is how much moose vary in almost all aspects. Some people think that moose are kind of stamped out with a cookie cutter and they're all basically alike and there isn't much variation. But I kind of thought that at one time. But one of the results of the study that I found was indicative of how much variation there is in the book, I've got a chapter on a female moose that was very successful at reproducing, and I followed her for most of her lifetime. I had her radio collared, and during a 10-year period when she was at the peak of her reproductive abilities, she produced 17 calves, and 8 of those survived, almost a 50% survival rate, at a time when the average in that population was somewhere between 10 and 15%. And so she was a very successful mother, and she was able to rear calves successfully when other moose didn't. I had some moose that I followed for a comparable period, some cows that only had one or two surviving calves during that same 10-year period.
Wow, so you can really see how evolution would work there, wouldn't you? Because such a successful reproducer is going to have a much bigger impact on the gene pool there.
That's exactly right, and I found the same thing with bulls. Another chapter in the book talks about a bull that was very successful. I followed him during the prime of his life, and during a 3-year period, he was the only bull I had collared that was able to maintain control of a breeding group of cows during the entire rut. Most of the other bulls lost fights and lost their dominance over their groups, but he was able to, through a combination of being a successful fighter and all the things that involves, he was able to maintain control for the entire breeding season.
And one of the things, I guess mating is really the whole name of the game when you're, for all of us, but especially, in wildlife, that's the sort of the point of existence to some extent. And you focus on that in the book, and you have this extraordinary picture of moose actually in the act of mating, sort of in a sunset. Like, it's really, really something. And that was kind of one of your focuses, wasn't it, seeing the rutting season?
Yeah, there were several different aspects to the Denali study, but one of them, which I have done from the beginning and continue to do now, relates to the mating season or the rutting season, trying to understand, as you said, why some animals are more successful than others. And then there's a whole bunch of interesting behavior that goes on during the rut that you don't see at any other time of the year. Another, I think, interesting aspect that we uncovered was starting right at the beginning of the study, we started to observe and record when we saw different behaviors start and when they ended. And we wanted to establish a kind of a schedule and try to see if that pattern remained constant over time. For example, the dates at which the bulls first lost their antler velvet, the dates when we first saw mating, the date when the rut was over, and that. And so during the first one or two or three years, we established those patterns. And then during the next 20 years, we found that those patterns were very, very constant. The first date, for example, when we saw a bull shed their antler velvet was August 25th. And over the next 20 years, that was the pattern. And then something changed. And for the last 15 years, everything has gotten earlier by about a week or 10 days. And of course, if you rut earlier, then if you're a cow, you deliver calves earlier. And what that corresponds with or correlates with is an earlier springs as a result of climate change, which has actually happened here. So that now we have springs being earlier, green leaves being available to cows earlier, and they've adjusted their mating and their birthing to correspond to that supply of food.
Isn't that extraordinary? Because it's such a complex set of relationships.
Short-term adjustment in environmental conditions, that's really to their advantage, because mm-hmm. calves need to have as long a time as possible to grow as big as possible to cope with bad winters. And if they have an extra week or 10 days at the beginning, it can make a significant difference.
So are we seeing population differences because of climate change? Has it gotten easier for moose to survive out there?
By and large, yes. During these mild winters, moose really thrive. And we've had a bunch of mild winters in the last 15 years.
Yeah, interesting. So Denali must be a particularly good place to study this because of the lack of hunting, right? Or are there other reasons?
For many reasons, it's one of the best places in the world. At the east end of the park, you've got moose habitat that's kind of typical of mountainous habitat throughout Alaska, and there's a pretty dense population of moose there. There's road access, which is important if you're a low-budget study. The moose have not been hunted, nor have the predators been hunted or trapped, so it's a naturally regulated system. And it's and the moose are tolerant of people and let you observe them. They haven't been hunted, they're not afraid, and you can observe them safely and efficiently from close range.
Yeah, and for visitors and for Alaskans too who go up there, seeing moose in the fall is spectacular, and I've seen them. The males doing their I don't know what you call it when they're butting their heads together, jousting or fighting.
Sparring,
yeah, in the fall. And which you can also see in Anchorage at times, but it's really a great place to see them, and you got a pretty good shot at it.
Yeah, it's one of the best places to go to observe moose year-round, really. I mean, in the springtime, there's cows with calves, sometimes right in the campgrounds at the east end of the park, and during the winter time, if you ski into the park or snowshoe in, you can see moose along the park road. There's a small number of moose that remain there regardless of how deep the snow is. So yeah, it's a great place to see moose and learn about moose.
I would think some of your findings would be important for wildlife management when we think about the fact that a few moose are responsible for such a outsized amount of the reproduction. Presumably, those would be the last moose you'd want to kill. And also climate change could affect when you wanted to have your hunting season. And have you, has any of your research fed into those questions of wildlife management, or is that one of your focuses, or has that not been receptive?
Yes. We've published a large volume of technical papers, and some of those have had implications for moose management, and they've been applied. One thing I've been interested in for years is predation on moose, and we've uncovered one significant thing in relation to predation, and that is, there have been large-scale predator control programs for wolves and bears here for the last 13 years. And there's an underlying model that was produced by short-term research in the 1970s and 80s that underlies those management programs, provides and justification.
And so this is the program where the state actually sends out folks to kill wolves and bears with the hope that they're going to increase moose numbers.
That's right. Mm-hmm. For hunters.
Yeah.
Increase moose for hunters. So this model has a couple different predictions that we have actually been able to test at Denali in our long-term study. And one prediction is that if a moose population decreases to a very low level, that bears and wolves preying on them can keep that population at that low level.
So it's and a predator pit, I think.
Predator pit. That's yeah. Exactly right. And that can persist for decades. So that's a prediction. The second prediction is if you do control predators, reduce them, that if the population increases, you've got to keep controlling predators, or else the predators will increase themselves and drive the moose population back down. Well, at Denali, we've actually got about 100 years of data from the time the park was first established to now. And we've got moose population trend information during that period. And what it shows is that when the park was first established, moose were scarce at the east end of the park. And for a 30-year period from the mid-20s till the mid-50s, the moose population increased. And for the next 20 years, from the mid-50s to the mid-70s, the population was stable. And wolves and bears were not controlled during that entire 50-year period. So one prediction that that model makes, that you've got a predator pit that moose can't get out of, was disproven by that Denali work. The other prediction, that you've got to keep controlling predators, was also not borne out, because that Denali population at a high level remained high for at least a 20-year period.
Interesting. It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about moose on today's show. Sort of such an important animal to so many of us in Alaska, whether we just enjoy viewing them or if we enjoy eating them or both. There's a lot to learn, really, and I think we see them around so much, we kind of assume we know it all, but I'm learning a lot today. I'm talking with Vic Van Ballenberg, who's a biologist who has studied moose at Denali National Park for 37 years. He's still at it, and he's also the author of In the Company of Moose, which is a really, really nice book with lots of photographs and with his writings in it. So this predator control issue has gone on and on, and it's been a perennial. And it's interesting to me that when we look at the predator control of the past, you know, eagles used to be destroyed to protect fish, and marine mammals were destroyed. But it seems like wolves are sort of the last ones that has been permitted. And I wonder if you feel like predator control really makes any sense at all.
Well, it can under certain circumstances, and it has resulted in moose population increases in some cases, but not all cases. So the trick is for biologists to identify those situations when, you know, we do the homework that we need to do in terms of doing field studies to assess whether or not predation is really the limiting factor, or whether it's poor habitat or bad winters or overhunting. It's not just predation that can reduce moose populations. There's a whole bunch of other factors, and sometimes they act together. So the first thing that biologists have to do is establish what's going on in the field to be sure that you're not wasting a lot of time and effort if you do control predators and not get a response. And we've had several cases where that has occurred in the past.
Mm-hmm. Do we need new models, or do we need a new thinking at the state level, or what is your critique of the current policies?
Well, I think we do need to reevaluate the old model that I mentioned previously. As I indicated, that was based on short-term research during the 1970s and 80s, and during that time period, of a big broad area of the state, including Denali National Park, had moose population declines. And the reasons for that are still not really clear. But during those declines is when this model research was done. And as I indicated, now in light of some additional information, maybe we need to reevaluate that model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you have spent a huge amount of time in the field with moose, possibly more than any other biologist studying them. And I'm interested in how you go about your work. How do you find the moose? How do you observe them? How do you gather the data that you're working with?
Well, the key to our success and that of all wildlife biologists, really, in most areas and over a broad area of the world, has been the advent of radio collars, which started in the 1960s at about the same time that I started studying moose in Minnesota. And in Denali, we've radio collared over 150 moose over this 37-year period. And what that allows you to do is a number of things that were never possible before radio collars came on the scene. We can follow individual animals for most of their lifetime. And we can look at things like reproductive success and mortality factors and basic behavior. And so that's been the first thing, is to have a bunch of radio collared animals. So in the morning we get up, we drive out the paved road. We get some crude locations as to where the moose are. We then walk out to them with a radio receiver and an antenna and locate them. And spend sometimes the entire day with them, observing and taking notes and determining who they're with and where they are and what kind of habitat they're in, and in the case of the rut, what kind of behaviors they're engaging in.
That sounds like a really fun job for someone who enjoys being outdoors.
Best job in the world.
Yeah. Does the research go on during the winter too, in the harsher weather?
We have done year-round work there over the years. I had some grad students there in the wintertime for a period of time. I've had some university collaborators that have been there in the winter and fall and summer. And so we've really done a year-round study. And more recently, in the last 10 years or so, it's been focused on the fall season, spring and fall, really, during the time when the young calves are first produced and during the fall when mating's going on.
How are moose able to survive such severe conditions as we have here in Alaska in the winter? I mean, we don't have elk, and we have deer in sort of the coastal areas, which have been introduced largely. But why is it that moose are able to get through these tough winters?
Because they've got thousands of years of evolution behind them that has shaped all aspects of their life, from obvious things like, why do moose have long legs? Well, it's not because they wade around in water. It's because they're more efficient at getting through deep snow.
Mm.
Why do they have kind of a square, blocky body? It's because that's more efficient at conserving heat. And the adaptations, there's thousands of adaptations that they have evolved from physiology to behavior to what their body looks like in order to cope with a harsh environment.
Is the northern range of the moose controlled by the range of the boreal forest and their food supply, or is it controlled by weather? What determines their range?
What determines it is what kind of habitat they require, and they actually go well north of the boreal forest. There's moose on the north slope in the Colville River drainage a long ways from trees, mainly because there's willows there. Willows are one of the main food sources of moose, and wherever there are suitable species of willows in abundance, you'll generally find moose.
So let's go through their food supply. You see them in the summertime feeding in ponds, obviously like ornamental plants around Anchorage, willows. What are the main things they can eat and what can't they eat?
In Denali, where we've determined that precisely, and it applies through other areas of the state and basically all the mountainous moose habitats in the state, the summer diet was one half of the summer diet was one species of willow, diamond leaf willow, in the summertime. In the wintertime, another species, felt leaf willow, was one half of the winter diet. And then there's about six or seven other species of willows that are in total about 80% of the total diet. And as you said, they also eat aquatic plants. They eat some herb-type plants. They like fireweed, for example, and eat it heavily early in the summer. And then there's some tree species. They like aspen. They like birch. And those things. They cannot eat spruce. Spruce contain toxic compounds that interfere with their digestive system. And some plants like alder and dwarf birch have also evolved chemical defenses against browsing, and moose eat those in relatively small quantities because if they have too much, it shuts down their digestive system.
Huh. So they load up in the summer and fall, and then in the winter, when there are few leaves around, they're kind of just scraping a little bit of bark and just probably using up stored calories, or are they able to really get enough food in the winter?
Basically, they acquire the energy stores that they need during summer to get them through the rest of the year, and summer here is defined by the time when they've got green leaves available to them, roughly from the 1st of June in Denali until the end of August. So June, July, and August, and that's when they grow new antlers, they grow a new hair coat, they produce fat stores. Bulls can gain 250 pounds during the summertime. That's when cows produce the most milk for calves, and so they do all that energetically. And then during the rest of the year, they're basically on a downhill slide until green leaves appear the next spring.
So they're really not getting many calories in the wintertime.
No, it's been compared to a human being existing on a diet of cornflakes, you know, high in fiber, low in digestibility, low in protein. The summer diet is about four times as high in protein as the winter diet.
Interesting. So how much time does a moose actually spend browsing? Is it and what is sort of the moose daily cycle? Is you kind of wonder what are they doing during the day? Are they browsing pretty much all the time when they're awake?
They during the summer prior to the rut, they don't spend very much time at all doing anything except feeding and moving and resting. They move from feeding spot to feeding spot, and that takes a minimal amount of time. They're feeding intensively, and they're processing that food, and they're spending about, during the peak of the summer, they're spending about 12 hours a day feeding. And then the remaining 12, they're resting and moving from place to place. They don't really interact with other moose very much, unless they have calves. And in the wintertime, that amount of feeding is basically cut in half. They can't process enough food because it's so fibrous and so indigestible in the wintertime. They've got to adjust their intake downward and their feeding time downward.
Are they like cows that they need to chew their cud and have a period of inactivity while they're digesting?
Yep, they chew their cud like cows and white-tailed deer and elk and caribou and all of the ruminants.
Huh. So, and then in the areas that they use, are they fairly loyal to a certain area? Or do they roam widely in your research?
They have home ranges in both the summer and the winter. And sometimes those are separated by quite a few miles. Sometimes we have moose that migrate, and I've had some of my radio-collared moose that have spent the winter 30 miles from where they spent the summer. Not all moose migrate. Some stay behind, and some don't migrate consistently. They assess the snow conditions, and during deep snow winters, they leave, and shallow snow, they stay.
Huh. So when they migrate, they're migrating vertically primarily, or what are they looking for when they migrate?
In Denali, they're getting out of the mountains and they're going out to the north onto the flats.
I see.
And they can go long distances out into the forest.
Well, I think this has been a fascinating conversation. I've learned a lot, and I recommend your book to listeners. I suppose it's available in bookstores and online.
Barnes & Noble and some of the local bookstores have it, and it's available at Amazon.com.
Victor Van Ballenberg, and we'll have a link to Vic's book on our website. It's called In the Company of Moose, and it's in the second edition. It comes from Stackpole Books. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Hi, listeners. I'm Eric Bork, the producer for Outdoor Explorer. This next story I want to share might be familiar to many of us and comes from Alaska Public Media's Ellen Lockyer. She's sharing a quick story of a calf moose in her backyard back in 2010. I really think you'll enjoy it.
After the winter snows melted at the end of April, I noticed a shallow depression about the size of a standard table platter at the very end of my backyard underneath the windblown willow. The earth covering the depression was undisturbed, and I ignored it and let May grass grow thick over the tiny sinkhole. I thought I should get a pickaxe and dig to see what lay beneath, but I didn't, until this week. I was maneuvering through dense downtown traffic when I got the panic cell phone call. My husband said, "Come home right away. There's a moose in a hole in the backyard." I knew exactly what hole he meant.
I can just get a rope up under his front haunches, you know?
It seems recent heavy rains in the city helped to destabilize the earth over the sinkhole. The yearling bull moose, browsing in willow trees, stepped onto the grass over the hole and fell 8 feet down into an old abandoned well. Fortunately for the moose, neighbor Bill Brownfield noticed the animal in trouble.
I saw him put his head up. There's a cow back here. It seems to me at least a year older. It could be a two-year-old cow that had this calf, you know, a year ago. She was over here eating, and I was just watching her, and I said, "Well, I better go check and see what's going on over there," and I said, "There's another one in a hole over there." And
the moose was not injured, but would-be rescuers could not figure out just how to get him out of the well. He was in too deep to climb out by himself. What to do? Fish and game biologists Rick Sinnott and Jesse Coltrane responded to the call for help. Old-fashioned elbow grease turned out to be the remedy. 5 shovels were rounded up and everyone pitched in to help dig around the perimeter of the hole to increase its size and lengthen it, while the soil falling downward piled up until the moose could just walk out by himself. With a little prompting, he figured out that's what we wanted him to do.
Come on, baby.
There you go.
Good job.
Good job.
Good boy.
Don't get
calf scampered off, none the worse for his adventure. Later on, Mama Moose made her appearance too, and all was well. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and our topic today is moose. Probably thought you already knew everything about a moose until hearing that last interview with Vic Van Valenberg and finding out, wow, there's an awful lot to know about them. My guest in this half is somebody who will be known to a lot of listeners in Anchorage, Rick Sinnott. He was an area biologist for Anchorage for a long time, and he's still involved as a writer and sort of a commentator about things that are going on having to do with wildlife here in town. Thanks for being with me, Rick.
Yeah, thanks, Charles.
I was just thinking back to, I think when we first met was when I was a reporter, a young reporter a long time ago, and you're probably a pretty young biologist, and there was an owl that was taking people's hats at Hilltop Ski Area, and we went out into the darkness with a recording that you had of rabbits in distress trying to lure the owl in so that we could, I don't know what we were trying to do, catch it?
Right, yeah, catch it and take it someplace else. Yeah, it was actually scratching some people's heads as well and causing all kinds of distress and grief, and it just seemed like a good idea before somebody hit it with a stick, you know, or something and killed it, yeah.
And did you ever actually catch the owl?
No, we didn't. The owl stopped doing what it was doing either because its territorial instincts, you know, lagged because it was the end of the nesting season or because somebody hit it with a stick. Yeah. We never knew. You know, people don't tell us those things often.
It was a funny, weird story. Mm-hmm. And it just makes me realize what an interesting and challenging job you did as being a wildlife biologist in the biggest city in Alaska.
Yeah, and the challenge, I mean, there's, I don't know, 20 or so area biologists for fishing game scattered throughout the state, but the challenge in Anchorage, of course, was that's where 40% of the population was, so I dealt with people a lot more than I dealt with animals, unfortunately, but also it was fun dealing with people.
Yeah, well, I mean, because the people were usually causing the problems, right? I mean, with bears, and today our topic is moose, and the moose were here first.
Yeah, I hate saying that because people get all uptight about it, but the moose were here first. We're here now, and it's a city, so, you know, we expect the animals to make some accommodations to us as well. But, you know, most people in Anchorage, by far the majority, appreciate having wildlife around, even large, dangerous, potentially dangerous animals like bears and moose, and so that made it a joy to work with those people. Then there are people that thought it was the most ridiculous thing in the world to have bears and moose in the city, and they were sometimes a little less fun to work with, but even those people are, you know, they're charged.
Yeah. Well, so I'm curious as to whether you think that there's that the city habitat creates better habitat for moose in terms of the numbers or less good. I know that it changes and that we can't say that the ecology ever stays the same. So when I was writing my history of Anchorage, I found some stuff from early in the 1900s, which talked about the fact that moose had showed up in Anchorage and that the Dena'ina really didn't use moose because it was forest here and there weren't that many moose. And then when the railroad was built, they burned down the forest and they got all kinds of moose browse and the huge population increase in moose. And now we kind of think of Anchorage as being a moose city. What is the population trend over time? How well do like ornamental apple trees and stuff stack up in terms of how many moose you can support?
Well, you made all excellent points. And that's, you know, my understanding as well is, 200 years ago, 100 years ago when the early white explorers came through and were actually writing down notes and talking to the Dena'ina that were here before, those folks were saying, well, in my grandfather's day, you know, there just weren't very many moose over in the Anchorage area, or even Tyonek. And with the fires and various things that went on, primarily the railroad, but also the miners were lighting lots of fires accidentally and on purpose, and home, and people were clearing homesteads and stuff, and it just cleared out a lot of the old growth forest that moose didn't necessarily do very well in, and created all these sort of open fields and edges where the new vegetation, woody vegetation, grew in. And it tended to be species that they liked, the deciduous trees, willows and birches and stuff. And so the moose population just skyrocketed. And there wasn't really any legal hunting in Anchorage until early 1950s. And when they had their first legal hunt, they shot hundreds and hundreds of moose that year, more than we've ever shot since.
Wow.
And they realized that, well, there's lots of moose, and we need to have a little more controls over who shoots what. And so after that, right, they dialed back for a while. But
they're probably pretty easy to find, too.
They were easy to find. But the numbers have kind of increased even since then. And with all the clearing that was done in the 70s during the big sort of the oil boom and everything like that, a lot of lots were cleared in Anchorage. And then no building went on. And those have reverted into natural browse. And that's changing now again in the last 10 years or so. A lot of those are being built on houses and parking lots and whatnot, roads. And so it's going to be clear that the moose population will decline over time. We're always going to have moose in Anchorage, but it's not going to probably ever be the heyday that it was back in the early 2000s.
Uh-huh. Interesting. So not that long ago.
No. That was probably, at least historically, from actually doing moose counts, that was the high period.
How many roughly have we had in Anchorage?
We estimated we would do pretty comprehensive surveys of Fort Richardson and Elmendorf from the air, and then some other areas in town, and from that we would sort of extrapolate for the rest of the city. But that's where most of the moose were, Fort Rich and Anchorage. Anyway, we would estimate as many as 2,200 moose in all of the. It was Unit 14C, which is sort of synonymous with the municipality of Anchorage. Mm-hmm. That would include Chugach State Park, Anchorage Bowl, Chugach Eagle River, all the way down to Girdwood. So 2,200 moose, we had estimated. Now there's probably something closer to 1,500.
That's still a lot of moose.
It's still a lot. We actually tried to increase moose hunting on the edges of the city and some places in the park and whatnot. And we kind of focused some of the hunting on cows rather than bulls because you get a kind of a bigger bang for the buck if you shoot a cow. There's less calves next year. And by doing that, we were worried because in the early 90s and late 90s even, there were so many moose in town that when we get a bad winter with 3 feet of snow and plus and, you know, all that stuff, hundreds of moose would die from starvation.
Right in the city.
In and around the city, yeah. Right, in the bowl. So we tried to increase hunting, and especially of cows, kind of in the edges around the city because that would lower the population of moose. And we did. We were successful in doing that. But also the whole long-term picture, like I said, of changing habitat is certainly going to decrease the number of moose in town.
So, I mean, their predators basically are cars, right? The cars kill them. There are not many wild animals that are killing moose within city limits, and there's no hunting in city limits.
Oh, in the city, well, if you consider the municipality of the city, mm-hmm. sure there is. There's hunting in Chugach State Park and Fort
Because we forget that right. The city actually goes almost to Prince William Sound.
The Anchorage Bowl, there's no hunting except on the hillside above the houses in the park in Glen Alps area. There's a limited hunt for cows up there. And, of course, at Fort Richardson, there's a lot of hunts for moose. So, you know, there's hunting kind of around the edges of the downtown area, but not so much right in the bowl itself. But anyway, cars are the biggest predators for moose probably in the Anchorage area. We do have a couple of wolf packs, at least one, maybe two still.
That's amazing.
And they definitely kill moose all around the city in Chugach State Park. And bears kill lots of moose, calves especially, in the spring when they're calving.
What an incredible place to live. It's just kind of mind-blowing, isn't it?
Bears will even come. You know, moose have kind of learned, at least partially, to come into the city to sort of avoid these predators because the wolves and the bears are kind of rebuffed a little bit by the city. But the bears, especially the black bears, have figured out that, there's lots of garbage in the city, and there's also moose calves at a certain time of year. So some brown bears and certainly a lot of black bears will chase moose calves around when they're just a few weeks old, trying to kill them or injure them badly enough that they can then find their dead bodies sometime later and eat them. Yeah.
So there's been effort put into, like, putting up fences and stuff to keep moose from getting hit on the Glen Highway and so forth. How successful has that sort of stuff been in protecting moose from collisions and also protecting people? I mean, you can certainly, it's, you know, a lot of lives have been lost by hitting moose.
Right. Yeah, it's a dangerous thing. Moose are much more dangerous to hit with a car than to, you know, come into contact with on a trail or something on your skis. But yeah, the fences, I'm not a big fan of fences. In some situations, they do seem to work a little bit. The Glen Highway fence, you know, it's I don't know, 8 or 10 miles long or something like that on both sides. And it's been improved over the years with the military end especially. But initially, it cut back on the collisions, but the moose have figured out that they just need to walk around the ends of the fence because that's not that far, you know, or through the gaps that people leave for roads, like Arctic Valley Road mm-hmm. is a big, huge hole. And a lot of the collisions with moose that still go on are right in that zone where they kind of walk right down Arctic Valley Road, boom, they're out on the Glen Highway. And then people aren't expecting them because there's a fence, right?
Right.
But the moose is like trying to crisscross. Now they're trapped between the fences because they're kind of bouncing back and forth across the road, and that causes problems. So the numbers of collisions, I think, have gone up, and DOT is always looking at ways to maybe reduce those again and maybe extend the fence so it's longer. But then you still have all these intersections where the moose can get into, and I'm just not a huge fan. Around the airport, it makes a lot of sense because mm-hmm. they very rarely get moose on the international airport runway, and that's a good thing because you don't want to hit one with your plane.
Indeed.
But in many situations when people propose fences, it kind of causes problems with the moose population because they have a harder time getting across the road, but they eventually figure it out.
Or get stuck on the road, like you're saying. Right. Yeah. So for pedestrians, for skiers, bikers, and so forth, moose can also be dangerous, especially if you zip right up on one, and which is easy to do on the new single track trails. And I remember a couple of tragedies over the years in which people actually were killed by moose in Anchorage. I mean, maybe for starters, let's just do a couple of tips about how to be safe. I know that I run into moose constantly. I'm okay with moose, but boy, do I get tired of running into them all the time when I'm running and biking. And in the summertime, I'll see people doing really risky behaviors with sneaking right up on them and trying to get pictures. Give me your 1 minute or 2 minute sort of safety lecture on like how do you behave around a moose
on a trail, for example,
on a trail or in Kincaid Park mm-hmm. or the guy who was killed years ago was, I think, on the university campus.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, they're big animals. They're potentially dangerous and they're wild, and you can't always predict what they're going to do. You can read their body language to some extent. If their ears go back and their hackles go up, and especially if you see them licking their lips, that means you're way too close and they're agitated. Oh. And it's best to let them have the right of way, back off, kind of make a big circle around them. The cows with calves, especially in the springtime when the calves are first born, May and June, they're by far the most dangerous moose because they're very protective of the calves. They're individually protective. Some are more so than others. But for the most part, you really don't want to approach a cow with a young calf or even mistakenly sort of run or ski between two of them that you don't see the calf on one side. So that's always a dangerous situation. So you can read their body language. Try to stay away from cows with young calves especially. And if you
and how much berth would you give when you're on a trail? I mean, do you how far do you have to go around?
Well, it always depends on the moose. You know, some mm-hmm. moose are used to people, and you can sort of tell by their body language, especially if they don't have a calf with them, that you can ski or ride your bike or whatever within 50, 60 feet of them. Mm-hmm. I would tend to be real leery of that myself, and I've been around a lot of moose. I'm very wary of moose, and if I see one, if I'm skiing on a trail or something like that, I will either wait for them to get off the trail, and sometimes they'll do that. But if they're unwilling to, it's the snow's deep, for example, and they're on the trail because it's the best place to walk, then you need to give them a wide enough berth that if they do charge you, you've got plenty of time to either take your skis off and you know, get behind a tree or get away from them somehow. Yeah.
And they're lightning fast.
They're very fast, yeah. They're different animals than bears, for example. They don't seem to chase running people. I mean, they mm-hmm. will sometimes if they're already charging and you run. Sometimes they'll run after you for a short distance, but they don't have the chase instinct that some of the predators like wolves and bears do. So, you know, running from them is always a good idea if they charge mm-hmm. you. Finding something to get behind, like a tree, and it can be a fairly small tree. People have successfully fended off a moose with a tree that's, you know, 5 or 6 inches in diameter. Mm-hmm. It's because, you know, you're kind of holding onto the tree and you're kind of circling it keeping it like a shield between you and the moose, and the moose is bigger, so it has a harder time running around that tree
sure.
than you do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And usually it's just enough to sort of break the link. So you weren't respectful for the moose in the moose's mind, you know, you got too close to it, and the moose is saying, you better back off. I don't want to kill you necessarily, but you better back off. And the fact that you're showing some inadvertent respect now that you're behind a tree and you're running or whatever, that's usually enough to convince the moose that you weren't that big of a threat in the first place.
Yeah. So it's only if it's like totally enraged and goes berserk, basically, that your life is really in danger, and people do get killed or seriously injured.
Right, and oftentimes it's because they just got too close. And so, like I say, each moose has an individual sort of a personal space bubble around it, and and it helps to be able to read their body language to know when you're close enough. But if you're just, and my advice is to be conservative and just give them more room than you think they need, because they really can move fast. They're as fast as a cat, at a short distance. And of course, the cows are more dangerous than the bulls, but they both use their hooves to lash out when they're running at you. So those hooves are big and heavy and sharp, and they can do a lot of damage. The human body is amazingly resilient, and people have had a moose sort of dance on their back, for a few seconds, and they get contusions and bruises and whatnot, and they seem to do fine. But moose have killed a couple of people, and they've injured, broken people's arms and stuff like that a few times in Anchorage, and so it's good to give them some space.
Yeah. Outdoor Explorer, we're talking about moose today, and my guest is Rick Sinnott, retired area biologist for Alaska Department of Fish and Game, who dealt with many, many moose in our midst. And he was always the guy with comments in the paper, and still writes occasionally for Alaska Dispatch News about different wildlife issues and trying to coexist, which is really what we have to do here. The single track bike trails have increased moose encounters, because the trails are narrow, they don't have long sight distances, you go pretty fast, and they kind of filled in all the, at some of our parks, they filled in all the spaces that were left between trails, so there's no really way for moose to get out of the way. Has that been a source of a lot of additional conflicts?
Oh yeah, quite a bit. And we kind of predicted it. I'm a big fan of biking, and I think single track is a great sport. But it's in the woods where the moose are, sometimes bears, and it's a kind of activity where it's almost designed for you not to be able to see very far ahead. Like you say, the trails are winding, they're up and down.
Right.
You're putting all your effort into the balance and the speed and the sort of the excitement of doing your own thing. And you've got a bubble too. You've got a 20-yard bubble, and you're moving fast. And so what happens, especially in the spring and in late May and June when the cows have their calves, in Kincaid Park and other places, they're looking for places that are sort of relatively quiet. They don't have a lot of people. And it used to be in the park, Kincaid, where it was primarily ski trails, and they were, average 50 to 100 yards apart. I mean, they're fairly closely packed, but all these ravines and little ridges, little moraines and stuff, glacial moraines, were kind of safe places. And the moose could be there, and they could be 50 yards, 20 yards from people zipping by and have no problem. Well, those places were sort of filled in by the single track bike trails, which are narrow and winding, and people go fast on them. And so the moose just have almost nowhere to hide anymore in Kincaid Park. And it's primarily been the cows with the calves, the young calves. And, it's to them, it's a huge threat, because someone is zipping along at a very fast speed towards them. And most other animals, if it was another moose, they would know that this cow was there because they could smell it. They would be aware, but you are just going ahead and coming at them, and as far as they know, you're coming after the calf.
Right.
So they're being very defensive about that, and it certainly has, people can't stop fast enough on their bikes in order to avoid the charging moose. So it's been, and some of these areas are very thick, even though there's trails all over them, you don't see very far, and even on either side of the trail. So it's just a perfect storm as far as wildlife encounters and dangerous encounters.
What's the solution? Just don't bike during the calving season?
That's what we've recommended to people. Yeah, May and June, especially early June. Those are the late May and early June. That's sort of like the worst time to try to approach a cow with a calf.
Just give the moose a break.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've run into them out there during the mating season when there've been moose sparring, which is great to see, but it's also a little bit alarming when you come around a corner and see that. But are they... they're probably pretty focused on what they're doing. On the other hand, they seem quite aggressive. Are they dangerous at that time too?
They are. I think on an order of magnitude, I think certainly cows and calves in the spring when they first have the calves are the most dangerous. Probably late winter is the second most dangerous time, because especially if there's deep snow, the moose tend to want to be on the sidewalks and roads and trails because that's where it's packed and it's easier to walk around. So, and they're just getting tired of winter like everybody else and kind of cranky. The third, probably the most dangerous time, relatively speaking, is the rut in fall, in September and October. And the cows aren't maybe so dangerous then, but the bulls are a little more dangerous than usual because the testosterone is flowing freely and they're looking to, you know, pass their genes on, and they're fighting with other bulls, and they've got a little harem sometimes of cows with them, and they're very protective of those. And sometimes we've had people that, you know, ran or skied or biked between a cow and several of its bull and several of its cows, and they've been treed. The person's been treed because the bull just kind of came after him. And the bulls are looking. The bulls are treating you in that instance almost like you're another bull. Not that they're confused by any, but they're just like, I don't want anyone around these cows. You know, just stay away from these cows. No, I don't care who you are. So it's hormonal, and the bulls don't eat much at all during the fall when they're rutting, and they're just again they're probably hungry. They're pissed off all the time, and they're looking for a fight. And you know, it's just a bad time to surprise one at close range.
You know, the other thing that happens in Anchorage, which is kind of one of the beloved things about Anchorage, I think, is these weird things that moose get into. You know, that there'll be a moose with a Christmas lights in its antlers walking around all winter, or a moose will somehow get stuck in a swing, or and what are some of the things that you encountered? Some of which I guess are probably pretty serious for the moose unless somebody helps them out.
Yeah, fences and anything that is strung up or dangles, they will get entangled in.
Mm-hmm.
And not so much the cows. The cows would get sometimes trapped. If there's a chain link fence that was built right next to a wooden fence and they're sort of right side by side with maybe a foot of space or 2 feet of space between them, a little bit of vegetation growing in there, a little bit of a willow or something, the moose will try to sort of push itself in there, and moose don't back up very well. I've noticed this over the years, especially when they're agitated, they just don't want to back up. They want to go forward. So they'll keep pushing themselves in there, and several times we had to...
So they get stuck between the two fences.
They get stuck, and we'd have to cut them out, and they wouldn't be very happy about that.
I could just imagine, like, okay, we've got a moose stuck between two fences, and you know, oh, it's Monday morning,
right?
Did you have to get called out at every hour of the day and night to
deal with
this?
Yeah, we would get... The troopers and the police would call us out, because there'd be it's a moose, it's not a human, so the police didn't want to deal with it, so they'd call us. So there's fences, and there's also the whole idea of even a low fence, a 3-foot fence like most people, many people have in their backyards, chain link, the cow can step over it, but the calf, when it's young, can't. Mm. So they're constantly getting separated, the cows and the calves, and then that's a dangerous situation because the cow's like, come on, come on, come on, and the calf can't do it. So now the cow's attacking anyone that comes into any of the yards around it and getting more and more agitated, so we'd have to get them back together. But the dangling things, it's swing sets, volleyball nets, fishing floats, you know, that people, you know, have dangling from a tree, like a rope swing type type of thing. The cows wouldn't usually get tangled up in those, but it'd be the bulls, because in the fall, when they've grown their antlers and they're sort of stripping they've got the velvet they've stripped off, and they're just kind of feeling like they want to test out those antlers, they will sometimes just naturally they would just put them in a bush and kind of rub them around and see what that felt like, but with all these dangling things, they do that with swing sets. So it looks like they're playing with them. They'll walk up to a swing set and just kind of stick their antlers in it and just start rattling it and twisting. And what happens then is one of those chains will get wrapped around a tine, and the moose will try to pull away and it can't, and that'll just throw it into a frenzy because now it's trapped. Right?
Oh, my gosh.
And so sometimes it can just rear back and just yank out of it or break the rope or whatever. But more often than not, it seems like they would get tangled up, and then they'd get more and more upset, and they'd be running in a little circle with their head tied to the swing set or the volleyball net or whatever, and then you'd have to get them out. And
how the heck would you deal with that?
Well, we had powerful drugs.
Okay, right? So you shoot it with a tranquilizer.
Yeah, and that usually takes 4 or 5 minutes to knock them out, but they would go down, and then you'd untangle it and give them the reversal drugs and get them up. I hated to use drugs because they were expensive. It was hundreds of dollars per moose. My budget was very small. And also, it's rough on the moose. You know, they're agitated. It's not the best time to be giving them a drug and knocking them out. And you're giving them this powerful dose just in order to be able to handle them and get this thing off.
Does that ruin the meat if somebody is going to catch that moose later?
It does. The FDA or whoever, you know, regulates these things make us put a snap a tag in their ear or mark them in some other way so that even up to 6 weeks later, if they get hit by a car or something or get shot in a hunting season, you're not supposed to eat the meat. So we would mark them, and then we would hope that someone would call us if the moose had a tag in its ear, and we'd say, oh, yeah, that moose was tagged, you know, 3 years ago or 2 weeks ago, and it makes a big difference as far as being able to eat the moose.
Interesting. Well, that's something hunters need to know.
Yeah. And the Christmas tree lights were sort of a minor thing. I mean, most of the time, the first year or so when I had the job, I would get a little excited about that because, you know, you got 20 or 40 feet of Christmas tree lights dangling behind a moose, and it's maybe kind of blocking his view in one eye or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I learned that for the most part, those will break off. They get them tangled up in the sort of the crotches of trees and on fences and various places, and they're so thin, they just snap them, no big mm-hmm. deal. But they would also get tangled up in dog yard cables or one-inch thick ropes and things like that they really couldn't break. And so in those situations, we would take a look at the moose and see, is it really causing a problem with it feeding or moving around? And is it blocking its vision so badly that it's going to get hit by a car when it gets on a road or something? And if it looked like it was really bad for the moose, we'd try to take it off, sometimes with drugs and sometimes by just untangling it with the moose not looking, kind of mm-hmm. a thing, which was rare, but we did that sometimes to save the drugs. But most of the time, especially with Christmas tree lights or those little white lights, we'd say, that's not so bad, and that's going to come off. And its antlers are going to drop off anyway in a month or whatever, and then the problem's solved. So we would just have to
probably just get calls about that one every 2 days, yeah.
We would get calls about the same moose frequently as it walked through a neighborhood, right?
So you dealt, as you said, more with people than with animals because you were in this urban environment dealing with wildlife. What was your sort of overall takeaway about people's attitudes? Were most people jerks about it? Did they like having the animals here? Do you think that we do coexist adequately with our wildlife?
Anchorage is an amazing place for that. And my office, people don't usually call Fish and Game unless they've got a problem. Mm-hmm. But people wouldn't call me up and say, right on, Rick. I just saw a moose in my yard, and it's the best. It made my day.
Yeah.
Mostly it was there's a moose between me and my car, and I can't get to work, or the moose just chased my child down the street getting off the school bus, or whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever, and people, and almost everywhere in town has had that. So I'd get people mostly calling with a complaint or a concern. Many times it was just a concern. I think I have bear scat in my yard. What do I do? Usually it was moose scat, and I would point, I would help walk them through that. But But we did surveys. Fish and Game did surveys, a couple big surveys. They were independently done by other agencies outside the state, universities, and Responsive Management, which is kind of a wildlife polling firm, world known. Anyway, that we had a couple of these surveys done, I think in 97 and 2009, and it kind of confirmed what I suspected, that most Anchorage residents, adults, that's who we were asking, over 18, I believe, most Anchorage residents were very comfortable with having wildlife in town, even big animals like moose and bears. And most people thought it was a good thing. And we even asked them, we didn't all ask all these sort of, how have you hugged an animal today question.
Right.
We asked questions like, even though big wild animals are potentially dangerous, do they make life in Anchorage more interesting? That was kind of a paraphrase,
right.
But questions like that. And most people, 80% or so would agree with that in Anchorage. So it was amazing. And there's the 10 to 30% that were on the other side, and there's almost no middle ground. Side of the spectrum, there are people who are like, heck no, that's horrible. It's a city, and inside the city limits, it's white, and outside the city limits, it's black, mm-hmm. and there's no gray area in between, And they could put their toe on that line sometimes, That's what I noticed just talking to people.
Yeah. I've run into that too, but I think that it's almost become the identity of Anchorage, and as we become more and more urban, people become more and more proud of having our urban wildlife. So, and I think that you had a really, really tough job, and I appreciate your doing it, but I also think pretty interesting job and rewarding. So thank you to Rick Sinnott for being with us today on Outdoor Explorer. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
And in the first half of the show, we heard from Vic Van Valenberg, who is a moose biologist who's worked up in Denali. Our producer is Eric Bork. Production assistant is Grace Bogene. She helps line up the guests and is a big help. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.